Hi, and welcome to Delayed Live from Edge City. We're here today with Brian Parks. We may have some noise going on here because there's a lot of stuff going on in the iDrum Gallery, which is where we are at the moment. Mr. Parks, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Robert. It's so. Can I call you Robert?
Well, you always have.
Well, I've never thought it when I said it.
Oh, okay.
I always held you in an esteem higher than that.
Higher than a Robert.
Higher than just a name.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, you are responsible, I guess you'd say, for the playing music in inaccessible places. What's the formal name of this enterprise that you do?
The formal name is Performances in Near Inaccessible Environs,
right.
Private and Public Spaces, which people leave out when they describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it puts pressure on us to always be in near inaccessible environs.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's anywhere. This, depending on your attitude, is a performance in near inaccessible environs.
Oh, absolutely. Right now, you mean?
Yes, right now.
Right, yeah.
And when a child wakes up and has breakfast with her parents, really that could be interpreted as such.
Mm-hmm.
It's a private space. And
mm-hmm.
I think a meal can be a performance.
Sure.
And I think, so it's really just a matter of, you don't have to come to any of the performances to experience them. It's really just it's a matter of perception that you
mm-hmm.
can adopt at any time in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an encouraging thing. So
mm-hmm.
it's just, address yourself in terms of what you're doing
mm-hmm.
and take it as seriously as you might take a performance. Because people take their performing seriously, but sometimes they will sacrifice aspects of their daily life in order to do it.
Sure. We're going to talk about some of your other projects, but what kind of places has this taken place in? And you've played with other musicians also, right?
Right. And I feel bad sometimes being the face or the voice of this or whatever it is.
Well, you sort of originated it, right?
Well, no, because
is it a collective enterprise originally?
I think it was. It's been between generally Daniel Clay, who is a guitarist in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and also a carpenter and a person.
Right.
And
that's good. That's always good.
That they're human.
Mm-hmm.
And Nat Slaughter,
mm-hmm.
who I think is less human, if you know Nat, but just because he's so perfect in all of his angles and in the way he's been sanded. And so let's say those three people.
It's a hard gig.
Right. And the only it started because of a description that I had written of where Nat and I had played sometimes for a press release we did that didn't, of course, do anything in our lives
mm-hmm.
besides give us the phrase near inaccessible environs,
mm-hmm.
which has been the semantic touchstone that people seem to enjoy or
mm-hmm.
talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say Daniel and I did a performance in October 2003. It was a 31-night performance in 31 different places.
I remember that, yeah.
And this was, I had, just been lent a harpsichord, and he played guitar, because I can't play pianos anywhere. Atlanta doesn't really have any pianos.
What do you mean it doesn't have any pianos?
There's just no performance venues with pianos.
Oh, right, I see what you mean, yeah.
So, and I really felt jealous of people that performed non-keyboard instruments
mm-hmm.
because they could just go anywhere and play.
Carry it with them, yeah.
Right. So the harpsichord sort of gave me that opportunity because it was, at least marginally portable.
Mm-hmm.
And so Daniel and I did this performance. And as we started playing through it, the places we started playing became more and more, obscure. I want to say the word abstruse here because I like the word, and
mm-hmm.
that's sort of the essence of it. Is it's more about places that are overlooked as much as they are hard to get to.
Mm-hmm.
That's because they're not necessarily inaccessible, but maybe sometimes they are ideationally.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much that you have to crawl through something to get there, although that can be part of it, but
mm-hmm.
and that's the sexy part of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there's these places that we just don't value because we're not really, they're not assigned value.
Right.
Either monetarily, socially that, this is a venue and this is not,
mm-hmm.
and this is a landmark, but mm-hmm. this is not a landmark, which is ridiculous.
So these are sort of trash sites or neglected sites, right?
Yeah.
Railroad yards or what? What are some of the places,
okay.
for example?
So, we played in the Krog Tunnel before. Now, that's an obvious place to play. Mm. But we didn't play on the sidewalk. We played in the absolute middle of the tunnel, in between two of the columns. Mm. The harpsichord was the perfect width just to jam up in the middle of them, and I was back to Beacons of Calm, and Daniel was.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a very perfect night. Mm. And it was just a perfect temperature. And I mean, people don't really walk through that tunnel, so it was a very transient experience for the audience. People might notice us as they drove by. They might open their windows for a second, but that was it.
Right.
So we stayed there a long time. That was a long performance. It was like two and a half hours.
Did you have people come by just specifically to do a drive-by to hear you, or how did...
Well, like, Karen Touch just drove by. I'd never met Karen, so that was a wonderful night for me just to meet her. But I actually didn't meet her. She just drove by, liked it, and just kept driving through constantly. And Nat Slaughter did that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a place we played that has a lot of, you know, appeal because of the aesthetic of that particular mm-hmm. place. And it's an underground Atlanta landmark, mm-hmm. what have you.
All the graffiti around.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very striking place. Mm-hmm. Should we have this person enter?
No, we're closed set right now.
Okay. So the second... Okay, so then there's a field outside of, say, the cotton mill lofts, which is in between this odd triangulation of the rail yard, the train yard.
Slight pause here for a second while we... that's right.
The CSX intermodal train, where they drop off all the train mm-hmm. cars, right, yeah. and make transfers. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, this big thing that comes through and lifts the cars. And
yeah,
then
this wonderful crane.
It's a science fictional kind of site.
There's that. There's the cotton mill lofts, which is also kind of science fictional. You know, mm-hmm. it's this place where all this drama occurred, like, you know, strikes in this weird town, like, that was imported into Atlanta to mm-hmm. do factory work. Mm-hmm. And then Boulevard, which is a street that, you know, ends in the federal prison.
Boulevard of Dreams, we like to call it.
So, you know, and then there's this field in this darkened area that's, so you don't even notice it's there, and it's this mm-hmm. very beautiful triangular field with some trees. Mm-hmm. So that would be a place we played, which is totally overlooked. There's all this activity around it. You know, mm-hmm. thousands of people are constantly there. They're in their residence, or they're driving by, or they're mm-hmm. working, but mm-hmm. no one is ever at that particular location.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a place we played. And then recently, there's so much, you know, I'm sure this is everywhere, so I don't want to act like Atlanta is some special place, although, you know, it is, but this town is getting just eaten.
You know what? Someone dropped something on Art News recently that Atlanta is the number one growth area in the city compared to any other
city.
In the country.
Right.
800,000, I can't remember what the time frame is, but 800 some odd thousand as opposed to New York, which was 400,000. I mean, it's massively growing. It's, you know? So it is special in many
okay,
ways, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if the numbers back me up, then I feel validated as a human.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, you know, there's just this. Part of my becoming an adult has also been seeing that nothing physical that humans create.
Are we hearing the coming of the ships?
Wow.
I think that's an installation outside.
I think, yeah.
I'd rather think it's the coming of the ships.
It was lovely, very tiny ships.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The value of things that man makes are treated very haphazardly because I think a lot of houses existed 100 years ago, but we have this weird thing where, like, okay, that one we can survive. We're going to treat it like it's this wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
But almost literally everything around it is so negligible, mm-hmm. we can turn it into anything and then turn it into something else and turn mm-hmm. it into something else and just keep wringing the value out of this space.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I see movies about people protesting the demolition of things or places, but in my experience as a young person in college or whatever, I didn't really participate in much of that.
Mm-hmm. Demolition or in the
protesting? I'm talking about protesting.
Okay.
You know, I'm talking about getting in the way of protesting.
Sure.
Because there's, like, this attitude about protesters now that, like, it's indulgent. Like, you know, oh, there's something, you know, you're making something into a new Vietnam or you're making something out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is that there's so much that's being done insidiously that when you do a physical protest, it seems like it's self-indulgent, but really, like, what can you do, you know?
Mm,
so you have to have these insidious protests.
Yeah, there's a feeling now that nothing really matters in that sense, that nothing makes any effect on
right.
anything else, much more than I think in previous years. I don't know what it is. I think it's just a complex multifarious, polyphonic culture now. You know, we've become sort of gerrymandered in all sorts of different directions.
Sure.
And, I mean, people are satisfied. They're fat and sassy and happy, you know, and until something happens, they're not going to, you know, they're not really care too much about some stuff. But that's for a little bit later on in the podcast when we talk about the Atlanta art scene a little bit more. But let me ask you more about your other projects, because I know you did the Bach 8-hour thing, right?
Well, no, it wasn't. Bach itself wasn't like it was a performance piece, but it wasn't like I could perform 8 hours of Bach right now. I don't have that much in my mind. Oh. I performed the Well-Tempered Clavier Book 2 in its entirety.
Oh, which was a long...
Yeah, it was about 2.5 hours,
yeah.
And it was for memory. And
that's pretty amazing.
It was to accomplish a few goals. One was to finish this... It was as a memory exercise to finish something that I'd started.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, let's say, in 2003, fall of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2004, I said, I'm really going to do this. And then it took me, you know, that much longer to fulfill it.
Mm-hmm.
As a behavioral experiment, it was, what do you have to sacrifice in your life in order to complete this goal? Which the answer was, you know, quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Although it wasn't like sudden, like, things in my life would drop off a cliff. It was just that they suddenly sort of dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you find yourself... you know, it's often said that purity of will is to will one thing, which I've always thought to be the case, especially now since I'm so distracted by, you know, 5 different things. Did you find that to be the case, that there's a certain happiness in that sort of...
I would say there was a purity to the compulsion of that exercise. Like, to do that exercise, myself is not dissimilar from you in that I am drawn to variegated enterprises and I like to get involved with things, but because of the pieces itself, mm-hmm. Something had to change in me in order to complete
mm-hmm.
it. Like, it just had to. I was compelled mm-hmm. to have life changes, mm-hmm. behavioral changes, in order to complete that piece,
mm-hmm.
and period.
Mm-hmm.
So the purity of the piece overtook or counterbalanced some of my innate... mental disparities
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of it, was to feel that one thing and to become immersed in it. And to also put on the persona of a concert pianist for reasons of theoretical performance. Mm-hmm. I'm not a concert pianist, but what if I were to become one? You know, because I can't become a professional athlete mm-hmm. and I can't become a construction worker because I'm really... clumsy and delicate and very ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so many things I can't do, you know, on an expert level, say. And I wouldn't say piano is really one of them either, but it's maybe the closest thing I had.
Well, maybe it's kind of like you're saying about the performative and the old saying on TV, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. That is, the performative now takes precedence over everything else. If you can somehow manifest the performative
right.
in your art or whatever, then that brings into existence the art itself somehow, in some mysterious kind of way, almost. Everything's become performative.
And even if it doesn't bring it out to anyone, you know, it brings into relief that persona within myself, you know,
mm-hmm.
but exactly what you said, you know,
mm-hmm.
like blurring that line between performance and my actual life
mm-hmm.
Revealed some important truths, and part of them were inadequacies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, this piece is my ideal, but can I do it? Well, I mean, yeah, I did it, and otherwise I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the piece itself... And I used this analogy before, but it was like a Tupperware that you can't quite close.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause
it's just a little too full. That was what the piece was in my mind. Like, it's a lot of music. It's 100 and whatever. It depends on the edition. But let's say 170 pages of very intense counterpoint.
Wow.
Hardcore preludes, fugues. You know, that's what it is. And I'd say at my best I had like 97% of it, but it meant that there were these pockets that I couldn't close on it, and I didn't know where they were. It's like you pop down on, like, okay, I memorized this one a little bit better, and then this one kind of flies out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I felt like coming up to performance. And on the nights of performance, I learned a couple things which maybe are not true across the board, but are basically true. Solo concert pianists do not perform concerts that are much more than an hour solo,
mm-hmm.
ever. B, solo concert pianists do not perform a concert program that it's even an hour 2 times in a weekend.
Hmm.
2 times in a row. Now, they do concertos 2 times in a row. They'll do concertos 3 nights
mm-hmm.
in a city, etc. But concertos, you're sharing time with the orchestra, and it's not going to be longer than 45 minutes. Those are the
mm-hmm.
longest
mm-hmm.
concertos. So I set it up for 2 nights, and then the second night, I felt so nervous. Like, I felt
mm-hmm.
so weak. It was like my... I felt like I was so, just not at all part of my body. And when I got up there to play, I could not find the first note.
So is this nervousness, or is just that from doing the first one, it's so debilitating, and the requirements of memory?
I think it was a combination
of
inexperience and feeling like after that first night, I had poured out all of my material. Mm. Like, I had done it, and I was scrambling to get it back in to do it again, and it was...
So it's not easier to do it the second time. I mean, most people say, well, wow, you went through the whole thing. And yeah. It's like, you know.
Physically, no. I mean, it was a physical issue. It was like I think thoughts are in some way physical. Like, they're little muscles, well, they're brain flex. Yeah. I mean, like, those thoughts had been spent. There's something that had been spent in me physically that I couldn't quite regain. And I'm not trying to get too grandiose here. It's not like I was some sort of hero who you know, managed to... It wasn't like that. It was a flawed performance. I mean, anyone who saw it will tell you that, I mean, there were mistakes and there was issues, and I was got a very generous review from the classical music critic in Atlanta.
Peter Rue, yeah.
Yeah, who was... I mean, he could have bashed it, but I think that he understood that what I was going through was beyond just, like... I want to perform. It was like this experience. And the audience had to go through it with me. I mean, it was an exhaustive experience for the audience. They had to sit there and deal with these pieces, which are nice pieces, but they're not Bach's prettiest. Mm-hmm. They're his most, let's say, compositionally integritist or something. You know, they're very full, interesting pieces, but they take a lot out of you just to listen to, even on a surface level. It was an experience we all went through, which is what I look for in my performances. It wasn't a dissimilar project from performances in near-inaccessible environs. This, again, was near-inaccessible, not in a physical way, but in an
internal sense.
And this audience had to go through something whether they liked it or not, even by sitting there. And
so how would you characterize then your, if you say you have an overall project, the way you're approaching it, just judging from what you said about this piece and accessible pieces, has something to do with limitations, both audience limitations and internal limitations? Is this your métier, shall we say, now?
Yeah, I think you're very close to it, and I wouldn't shy of it. I have that much clarity as to what it is, but I will say this, that I do feel there has to be a change in the way that music is experienced in all of its formats and all of its conduits in order to move music forward. And what I mean by that is that composers really love to believe that no matter what music they're writing, let's say aesthetically, they are dealing with form in a deep way. So some people are tonal, and some people are atonal, which, let's face it, is the same thing. And some people write electronic music, but they would all say, like, well, I'm dealing with form, you know, which, to a lay person's perspective, could be something as simple as A, B, A, a beginning, a middle, and a return to a beginning to comprise your ending. And that could be done emotionally, happy, sad, happy, like a lot of children's books are or something. Or sad, happy, sad, which a lot of Thomas Hardy books are. So, but I think that form has changes with time, just like sound changes. And...
Hold on a second.
This is lovely.
Yeah. Okay. We won't be answering that phone. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, the standard venue of audience paying money and seeing what they perceive to be an expert perform, I don't need to do that. Like, that's done all the time, every day, and the stricture of that becomes more and more clear, and we have this more and more this aura of, oh, this person's a professional musician or this person's a pop musician, and the labels are so clearly defined, and you identify yourself with what music you like, and it's your persona, and it's your lifestyle, and it's your outfit, and it's how you it's your habitation, and it's what differentiates you from the person who lives next door or the person next to you on the bus, because you have different soundscapes in your ears because of, let's say, iPods, which I'm not... Yeah, I have a problem with them. But it doesn't have to be that way. And more importantly for me, it should never be that way, because it doesn't even matter what I play. It matters the fact that, like, it's hopefully an experience that is popping this bubble that we're kind of trapped in. And...
The bubble of what? Of this balkanization? Or are you bemoaning the lack of a common space, a sensus communis, as they say? Or what?
I'm saying that...
What would be a better...
We're stuck in the stricture of audience and performer in such a way that there is no chance for disaster. There's no chance for unexpectedness. There is only this... I pay money, I see what I expect to see, mm-hmm. and I'm affected, and I'm affected in a way that is predictable. Let's say music is emotional. I go and I see a song I want to hear. Just in the same way that bands get trapped by recording.
Mm-hmm, sure.
When you record music, in some ways you kill it, because let's say I perform it with you every time, and it's a little bit different, and then we record it, and then suddenly the next time millions of people press play, it will always be the same.
Yeah.
And then you're pressured to play that way, maybe in performance, or your audience has heard it that way and only that way. Mm-hmm. So music has become dead, and it's like all you can do is be this simulacrum of the music you recorded, etc. And so this is wholly opposite. This is like, I'm going to do something that I have no idea what it will be,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to go somewhere where you have no idea what it will be. I don't want your money. I don't want you to pay money for this. I want it to be an experience that we all go through, because maybe that's new.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always disliked it when people would say that person's doing something just to be different, because what the hell's wrong with that reason?
No, absolutely.
It's a great reason. And to be truly different, I mean, that's, like, really, really hard. I'm not saying that I'm truly different. I'm saying that, like, yeah, that's my goal.
I always thought that that's what art was supposed to be about, actually.
Yeah, finding
new...
What's the problem?
Things, right.
You know, I think it's people get very resentful of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that... It's we live in a world where we can see so many different things easily by looking at the internet or having access to things. So it's very easy to shallowly or superficially take upon the outfits of something that's different, but it's not deep. And maybe by just going through a true experience of time, time is important, duration, it takes time to find these performances, or time to invest in these performances, and you have nothing to show for it. You have no ticket, you have no recording, you have nothing to really prove to anybody. And it's also the smell of it, you know, like... If you're in a... So, what's near and accessible? Yes, geography. Climbing through a fence is hard to do. Whatever. But also, what if it's in a cold place? What if it's in an inconvenient time?
Mm-hmm.
What if there's a smell that's unpleasant around you? What if it's hard to hear because of the extant sound that is in the space?
Sure.
Which, in our society, we live in a world of almost constant noise.
Mm-hmm.
And earplugs for, let's say, iPods are almost more like earplugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Yes, you get to hear what you want to hear, but you're also blocking out, you know, other sound or willfully ignoring it, etc. So we're having to face all of those things in these performances.
So would you say that you're trying to restore a sort of an experiential aspect to it? Because, you know, some writers have said that, primarily Walter Benjamin, but other people, that the 20th century saw the beginning of the demise of experience, basically, in some sense. And now, and of course, Jean Baudrillard and some of those people, you know, talked about the simulacrum. In fact, what our experience is given to us, just like you were saying about the iPod and recorded music, it's given to us in a pre-digested, pre-genreized, pre-formatted sort of thing.
Sure. So, it's a lot like food.
Yeah,
I mean, music and foods are more related than I could ever imagine. I mean, the fact is the most accessible...
And thought, generally.
Sure. Yeah. The most accessible food out there, the easiest food to get... Without a doubt, for everyone, I mean, all over the world, is, let's say, fast food. Let's say McDonald's. I'm not trying to say I hate... I mean, obviously, it's not taking a stand to say I hate McDonald's, but, like, it's there. It's out there. And it's probably, most people would agree, not good for you. It's not good food, but it's the most available. Just like there's music that is incredibly readily available.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you try to make your music readily available, the more you're making your food, your music, like McDonald's. You're making it a product that is almost meaningless. It's so present.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see artists or composers who are like, I can't get my music out there, it's like, well, that means you're probably... good just by the nature of not being able to get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what makes things bad. If no matter how good a band is or music is, when it gets out there, it becomes so cheap and it becomes so, like, thin and it becomes like a penny.
Well, or it becomes like American Idol or a reality TV show, which is now the baseline for what people think aesthetic experience should be. I think that is, you want to be loved by the greatest number of people, which is always, to me, counter to what art has always been about and music. Maybe people would say, well, that's what the avant-garde was all about. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, like, history would say both. I mean, we have great people who are beloved and who are followed, and then we have, you know, demagogues that lead the genocides that are people that are followed. I mean, like, you know, a lot of people have followed very evil... I don't want to say evil, but have followed, you know, behaviorally synthesizing movements because of that hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, we all have to deal with it. I mean, as we can become more and more populated, we actually have less and less difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an evolutional necessity.
Mm-hmm.
We can't everybody be doing different things. Everybody has to kind of, like, become a dense, like, force that acts the same way. But getting back to the experiential thing, like, it's very obviously it's very didactic to say that I am going to make people experience things, and right now they're not. But just for me personally, mm-hmm. I want to experience things. Mm-hmm. I don't want to die. I don't want to go through my life and not have work for these things. And I mean, like, I don't farm my own food. I also don't build, let's face it. I mean, when I'm improvising music or something, no, of course I'm not. I'm not like mining the ore and the plastic that makes a piano or an instrument. That stuff's given to me. Mm-hmm. All musicians who say they're improvising, they're not improvising. Mm-hmm. They're usually buying instruments and mm-hmm. the tones are there. I mean, it's mm-hmm. easy. Mm-hmm. So much is already compromised, but yes, I want to go through an experience with the people that I love and the friends that I have and the people that I'm with in this city that is entirely ours, mm-hmm. that you cannot experience unless you're with us, mm-hmm. unless you're with me, unless you're next to me. And I cannot experience your life unless I'm mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. But when we are sharing the same CD, yes, there's like a community to that. Like, oh, I'm in Singapore and you're in mm-hmm. Seattle and we're both listening to, you know, Arcade Fire, and that's sweet, but it's also like really depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it's the community of the commodity, you might right. say, rather than the community of the saints.
The immediacy of locality. You yeah. know, there's mm-hmm. it can never be actually compromised because it's always a real thing, but in some ways it has been changed, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, you can find similar experiences in disparate places.
Mm-hmm. And, well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the country now, you can go from the West Coast to the East Coast and basically not leave the same sort of environment, you know, the strip malls, the different kinds of environments, and most people, that's what they choose to want to do. They don't want some kind of.
Well, I don't know if they choose it. You know.
Well, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. That's what they're given.
That's what they're given, and they're given this idea of variety also. Mm-hmm. But variety is the illusion of choice. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you have 8 different fast food restaurants, do you really have 8 different restaurants, or do mm-hmm. you have the same exact choice? Mm-hmm. And you know, also, let's say this is in Atlanta. I mean, like, Atlanta should not be great because if we have 1,800 different neighborhoods from the low 300s. You know, that's the thing that, like, I'm seeing. I think when I was 5 years old, that's what I would see so much. If I would drive by a place, and instead of seeing trees or a forest, I would see these really horrible-looking houses that say from the low 300s. And I hope I'm not insulting anybody, and I hope I'm not insulting my future self, who might live in one of those houses. I'm just saying, like...
Well, it's like the piano or the saxophone or the guitar. You're going to be buying the same one as some other guy.
Yeah,
or some gal,
I'm not trying to say I'm better than anybody. That's not part of this. It's just saying, like, there has to be some place that you go that really isn't that, you know? Mm-hmm. And even that... What's ironic about this is even this thing we're talking about has been capitalized upon by capitalism. Like, mm-hmm. when you go through a Delta run... what is it called? Delta... When you walk to the plane...
Delta Dash or whatever.
No. When you're on the airplane, you walk to the airplane from the terminal.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
The tube that scares you.
I can't remember what that's called. But
no,
yeah.
It's like the air-conditioned dream.
The tube that scares you.
Right, yeah. The tube. So... It has those posters that say secret places, you know, mm-hmm. and it has like a picture of the High Museum for Atlanta's, and it has like a, but I mean, like, even that mm-hmm. idea of like, hey, there's secret places everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, you can go to, you know, Chicago and find this place, but also I photographed it and now you're having to look at it in every right. city. Like, it's so creepy. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, the great thing about performances in accessible environments is, in private and public spaces, sorry, I don't want to leave it out myself, is that we can't go anywhere with this. Like, it doesn't matter how much press we get, we don't need any money. We don't need any publicity. Like, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't mm-hmm. change it. Like, we're already doing the best that we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And, like, Daniel's career is changing and Nat's career is changing. He's in New York and, you know, I'm going off to graduate school and everything is going to change, but it's like, anybody can do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously, like, anybody could just say they're doing a performance mm-hmm. in accessible environments, private and public spaces, and they would be right. I would have no argument with them and I would love them to do it. Like, it can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. We've gotten some press, but, I mean, who cares? Like, what are you going to do? Give us funding? Sure. Like, we can't do anything with it. Right. I mean, you might pay for some gas, but,
it
like,
goes to where you want it to go, anyway. Which
yeah.
is internally kind of thing.
I mean, you could... I guess people could pay us just for, you know, to give us money, but that's really all we'd be doing. Like, it's done. I mean, mm-hmm. And hopefully it can just be this. Going to places and playing and sharing some sort of moment. And, you know, when it's over, every time it's like this... It's like time has just for a little bit stopped because we're just sitting there and no one knows we're there because mm-hmm. this place doesn't, it's not like usually the places aren't active, let's say that, you know.
Right.
Yes,
sure.
There are a lot of abandoned buildings which have this sort of like abandonment has this, you know, this thing of like it's been overlooked, like a time isn't there, like nothing is there. It's just this silent pocket, which is just great. And so you can just stand there and just sort of feel protected. And
Along with abandonment comes the idea of abandon with great joy.
Sure.
It's sort of an ecstatic sort of thing. So you can't have one without the other, I think. You know, there's a certain amount of abandonment in the emotional sense in order to get to that ecstatic sense, which can, frankly, for people nowadays, is a frightening concept, because we're more and more, as you said, happier in large consuming herds. And I, you know, like you, I'm part of that herd, you know.
I think that everyone... on both sides of a political fence or what have you, we all have pretty deep addictions to information. You know, I think that's something everyone shares, and we share it in similar ways. And it gives, you know, just like the Bach thing compelled me to go through a process I wouldn't otherwise have to go through.
Sure.
When I'm in these performances, I'm having to assume a focus that I don't otherwise have. So... you know, it's this large-scale composition. I feel like I need to keep doing these, and in doing these, I will have to become a performer of my own score. And it makes me, you know, it's a self-imposed humility that for me is very hard to have, you know, because, you know, I want to do great things and have great thoughts and do important things, but by doing this, it makes me so anonymous. And the abandon is the abandonment of any pressure. Like, no one's going to judge this, and no one's going to write this down and say I was a bad composer or a good composer or a good musician or a bad musician because, what, two people are showing up?
It's like a rock beside the road, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's no more or less important than any other place there could possibly be. You know, it's sort of like when you're a kid and you have a stopwatch. Okay, a kid past 1985. But and you're trying to stop it, like, on 1000. You know, trying to get it perfect. But, like, the odds of you stopping it anywhere are all equal. Like, it doesn't matter. You're going to stop it somewhere. And every number is as good as any other. Like, your goal becomes sort of immaterial.